Investment Management Operations is brought to you by Intelligo. Intelligo is the premier due diligence platform delivering innovative pre-investment background checks and continuous subject monitoring for some of the most sophisticated asset allocators. Their individual and company background check reports blend the critical discernment of human experts with cutting-edge AI, ensuring you receive the most thorough and rapid insights. Groups like Common Fund, Adam Street Partners, Felicitas Global Partners, and past capital allocators guests Hamilton Lane, AIM13, and NEPC leverage Intelligo to mitigate risk and enhance their operational due diligence process. Visit intelligo.ai to learn more. Hello, I'm Ted Seides, and this is Investment Management Operations. This show explores the inner workings of the most sophisticated institutions in the industry. Through conversations with executives across operations, compliance, legal, and finance, you'll hear how key operating partners run their businesses in an ever-changing and complex investment landscape. You can join our mailing list and access Capital Allocators content at capitalallocators.com.
I'm Scott McDonald, and I'm your host. My guest on today's show is Carl Sprouls. Carl is the COO at AllianceBernstein, a global asset manager with $725 billion in assets and over 4,700 employees. I really enjoyed speaking to Carl, as it shows that you can still be nimble at scale. We cover a lot of territory, from his beginnings at Alliance Capital in the technology group, navigating the merger that created AllianceBernstein, and his evolution into the COO seat. Carl shares how AllianceBernstein has evolved over time and the rationale behind the bold decision to move their headquarters from Manhattan to Nashville, creating a new investment management hub and recalibrating work-life balance for many people. We then turn to how AB is expanding into Asia, India, and their current thoughts on AI. Please enjoy my conversation with Carl Sprouls. Carl, thanks for joining me today. I'd love to go back and share a little bit about your career path and your journey at AllianceBernstein.
Thanks for having me. I'm a software engineer by trade, or at least started that way. My first roles as a software engineer were in defense and cellular development, which I enjoyed. I loved working in a lab each day, focused very much on single products. But after a while, I started to think about where could I get the most leverage for the technology skills that I had. And I had an interest in finance. And so I went to an open house, in fact, that HSBC had. They were trying to entice people from the engineering world over into finance. And I went up to London for the evening and I was just surprised, actually. I was blown away, in fact, by the amount of technology they had and the complexity and also the depth of technical understanding of the folks they had there. And so I joined HSBC in the late 90s. So that was really my first finance job whilst they were going through the transition to the order-driven market in the UK market, the SETS transition. And so I worked there for a while, loved HSBC, loved the scale of it. But after working in engineering, I was used to working in reasonably small teams. And so I thought I'd have a look around and see if I could find a team that was of a smaller size. And that led me to Alliance Capital. And that's where my 26-year journey here started.
And when did the merger occur with Bernstein?
Well, I started at Alliance Capital in late 90s. And I joined to work on a reasonably small software project that would probably have taken about 18, 24 months. The London office was quite small. I think there were only a couple hundred people there at the time. And so I figured it would either be a short-term gig or something that led into sort of more opportunity in another part of AB. So I got through that project in about 18 months and I had the opportunity to come out to New York, which is where Alliance Capital's head office was. It was right at the time, early 2000s, when the web was really just starting to have an impact on everything, but it was starting to be seen as a place where not only would the firm use it for the distribution of marketing materials, but also an area where we'd start to use it to connect more with our clients, whether those were distribution clients or whether that was our end clients. And so I came out to the US for what was going to be a very short period of time, a few weeks, to help on a project that we were doing around client-facing websites. And after coming back with some forwards for a few months, I got offered the opportunity to lead what was going to be our internet engineering team. And then 2001, Alliance Capital announced it was going to be purchasing Bernstein, and that's really started the integration of the two firms. And I was very much involved in that. One of the areas that came across as part of the merger was the wealth management business that Bernstein has and we still operate today. And that was my first opportunity to get really close to our clients. And so I spent time working with the wealth management team. They had built a client-facing website that was deployed out of a team that was in California. So I went out to work with them. And then over the next few years, I ended up being more and more involved in the wealth management business. And so I ended up running all of the technology for that team and the operational systems for that team. It was fantastic. It was a real lesson in both how you deal with high net worth individuals and how you think about client service and all the complexities of managing the wealth of family offices.
And when you trying to get up the curve on the wealth management side, what comes to mind is some of the key areas that you had to focus on to convert to that larger market?
Yeah, that's interesting. When you think about high net worth individuals, how they think about their finances is quite complex, and how they want to see their relationships shown to them in terms of what have they got focused on their long-term future? What are they thinking about for other parts of their family? What are they thinking about around charitable giving? My initial experience was around really thinking about the reporting side of things. But as I became involved in more broadly in their technology, it was, how do you think about CRM? How do you think about structuring the CRM system? How do you think about building the reports in those tools? How do you think about client service? How do you think about opening an account? How do you do that as quickly and as painlessly as possible? How do you think about long-running processes that run through the organization? So an asset mix change or a cash flow, things that touch lots of different departments. So a large part of the technology we built there was workflow-based. And then after I ran technology for wealth management, I had the opportunity to run technology for equities. But whilst I was in wealth management, you got to see really how that interface between the servicing and the front office for sales worked and how that integrated with the portfolio management tools and the portfolio construction tools. And so coming up to speed about how we think about our clients' asset allocation, how we think about the different sleeves in that allocation, how we think about managing them, how that information is reported back to the sales systems. That gave me a good foundation for the equities role that came next.
Are those tools, are they still around today?
Some of them. So some things got largely commoditized in the market. So we built our own CRM system, if you go way back. But then there are tools out there that have got large market shares today that we've migrated onto. I'm a big believer in you encapsulate the processes of the firm inside of software. The tools that do a lot of the orchestration of how we work, so the tools that are responsible for some of the processes I mentioned, opening an account, managing cash, managing asset mixes, putting the accounts on hold, all of those tools, those are homegrown orchestration platform that we call ACE. It's been very powerful for us. It's allowed us to get a lot of operational leverage and allowed us to get a lot of control over complex operational process. And those tools we've built and built on top of those over the years. That platform's probably 20 years old at this point, but we've kept up with the technical debt low on it and we've built a lot of process on it. We have a few of those around the organization where they're like areas, pockets, where they sort of really encapsulate what we do and we've focused on investing on them.
With regard to the merger, how do you get consensus on technology changes when you have two organizations coming together?
That's tough. Those were two very large technology organizations. So I think, first of all, you've got to work together. When you get pushed into those dynamics, when you've got two different teams who are used to working in different hierarchies, you've got to come together as a team. Now, remember, this is over 20 years ago for the merger between Bernstein and Alliance Capital. So my role at the time is very different, but the folks who were leading that did a good job of bringing the teams together. Then you've got to really think about what adds business value and what doesn't. And on the Bernstein side, there were some very specific tools that they'd invested in. I mentioned this idea of encapsulating the business process or encapsulating the vision. They believed very much for their wealth management clients in separately managed accounts. They believed in the tax management benefits of that. Their philosophy was an optimization from where the account is today towards a set of targets. In many cases, they were ahead of the curve for many years. And so those tools were quite important. So you look for things like that, that just really encapsulate the business. And you say, look, those are non-negotiable. You've got to bring those into the infrastructure. So that's at one end of the spectrum. And at the other end of the spectrum, it's, you know, core infrastructure, desktop server, network. But what are the things that are a commodity. To use a modern day example, if I think Amazon and you think Azure, they're both great. They both do a good job, but do we need both? And so you go through the process of looking at that. I've been involved in bringing on many small teams and other inorganic acquisitions over the years. And when I go through that process, if all things are largely equal, tend to look at what's going to be the biggest lift. So there's that part of it. And then there's a sticky piece in the middle, which tends to be where most of the work is. You might have the same CRM platform, but you may have used it very, very differently. So that's the stuff that gets hard, because it's not just about moving a software platform. It's about changing a business process, coming back to this idea that the software encapsulates the business process. So you got to get that done first, and that requires partnership up and down the business to do that. So that, I think, tends to be the long tail. And in some cases, it's just too hard to do. And you end up saying, okay, we're going to run these things independently until some point in the future where it's easier.
So after you were there for a while, where did your career progress from there?
So if you go through my career path coming to the US, it was really about taking more and more responsibility. Started off in web, ended up running wealth management, technology, wealth management operations. At the time, the guy who ran our client group, which is the group that services our institutional clients and our retail intermediaries, he brought the wealth management and those teams together. And so naturally, I ended up managing the technology for all of the stuff that touches our clients. So if you think about my career up to that point, it was really about getting more and more responsibility. It never been a point where I'd given anything up, really. It had been a case of, can you also manage this? Can you also manage this? And it's quite an interesting lesson. It's a lesson I talk to people about often, which is up to that point, that's how I thought you grew inside of an organization. You're just going to give me incrementally more responsibility. I was asked if I would go and run technology for our equity investment business. And like I said, I had some experience of the sell side of that at HSBC. I'd seen some of it on the wealth management side, but it was not an area where I had deep experience in portfolio construction. You've got portfolio optimization. You've got compliance, order management, execution. These are areas that, sure, I could tell you what they were, but could I know them in depth? No, not at all. And so it was the first time in my career where I had the opportunity to take a step in to do something completely different and give up everything that I'd done before. And I've seen this happen many, many times. You see people who go through that transition, they never want to give anything up. And I didn't want to give anything up, and I had 10 ways from Sunday as to why I should do both. Over time, I've learned that that's the better approach in terms of building your career, is to make some of those hard cuts where you actually go, look, I'm stopped doing this. I'm going to do something else, because the complete change of domain is great from a learning experience. But also, in giving up what you've done in the past, you only have the focus of the new thing. It allows you to develop quicker. It allows you to come up to speed faster. And so I had the opportunity to do that, and it was great. It was a life-changing experience. I got to work with the head of the business, a lady called Sharon Fay. She was a very prolific investor. I had a very clear view of what she wanted to do with the business, which had been built through the amalgamation of a bunch of companies. We had Growth and Value coming together with Alliance Capital and Bernstein. We had some other styles that we've added on along the way. So when I got there, there were probably 8 or 9 different ways to get from a portfolio management decision to the trading desk. Her challenge to me was, there must be a simpler way of doing this. We must be able to do it with less of these workflows. And so I spent 5 or 6 years doing that, which we ended up putting in a much more streamlined process and dramatically reducing the complexity and the cost of that area. So that was a great learning experience. And another opportunity, I guess, coming back to this idea of, okay, you need to give something up to really get a jump in your career. The other thing that I found that was really helpful is, in moving into that role, I had a real partner in the business with Sharon. She really had a vision for what she wanted from technology, and she was a strong advocate for my ability to do that. I enjoyed that time a lot working in equities.
And back to this whole transition and taking on more responsibility, why do you think it's so hard for people to delegate?
I'll answer that question through the lens of being an engineer. When you first start writing software, you have control over everything. And that process of going through, okay, I'm the only person on a project, you usually start working on small things, or you'll delegate a small piece of something. The process of going through that learning curve to the point where you own a product and have to delegate things out, that's fine when you're hands-on with it and you're in control of all the pieces. As an engineer, when you step out of that and you have to start to deal with things that are more nebulous and you aren't in control of the details. I see that as a problem that many people who've had that engineering background face, which is they're just used to understanding all of the pieces of the puzzle. And when you get into broader management, you don't have that level of control, and nor would you want to. That's a hard lesson to learn. One of the things that I've always believed about AllianceBernstein, and I believe that as COO, it's my role to help AllianceBernstein, is I want us to be an employer of choice. And one of the things about being an employer of choice is talent. And one of the things I've felt that helps in the long term to keep the best talent is you give them opportunities that they're not even aware that they would be able to accomplish. You give people these stretch goals that are just like, wow, I didn't even think someone would trust me to do it, let alone would I be able to knock it out of the park. And so I just had the opportunity to work for people who saw the world that way. So whenever I've had an issue, maybe thinking I should be doing that rather than delegating it, there was usually too much to do to not be able to have that thought process. So maybe I was lucky in that regard.
When did you get the COO role?
I'd always been involved in the infrastructure of the firm, and I'd always been part of the team of people who set the sort of overall technology strategy. The guy who was running technology and operations at the time asked me if I would take the CTO role alongside the equities role. And so I did that for a number of years, working closely with the engineering and the operations teams on the broader technical infrastructure. And that was a great time because it was right when productivity technology was really having an impact. iPad had just come out. The idea of collaboration and communication tools at everybody's fingertips, tools for collaboration outside of email. So think group chat and one-to-one and instant messaging was starting to become more and more part of the firm. I had a great time as CTO focusing on those things. At the same time, we'd gone through a number of challenges in terms of business resiliency. And so I'd focused on virtualizing everything, virtualizing our entire infrastructure in the data center, but also virtualizing everything on the desktop. I wanted to make sure long, long time before COVID that we could work 100% remote should we need to, and that we could have geographic independence. That was the CTO role, and that gets us to about 2017. And around that time, the guy who was the COO asked if I would co-head technology and operations and also be part of a team that was going to look at where our next head office would be. And I always assumed that would be in New York, but as it turns out, that started a journey that led us to Nashville. And along that way, so I moved to Nashville in 2018, and in 2019 became the global head of technology and operations and real estate, which is that idea of technology being a big part of our workplace, managing real estate and the technology pieces together was very helpful. And then I became COO in the summer of 23. So I'm just over 9 months into the role.
It's been a slow evolutionary burn. It feels like making your way to that role. It also, I think, AllianceBernstein has had some great notoriety for making a very bold move to Nashville. Can you give us a little background on how that came to be and pulling out of New York? You have a massive talent pool. Tell me more about how that evolved.
Yeah, so you really need to start around 2016. At that time, we had 1.1 million square feet of real estate in New York City. We had 400,000 square feet in White Plains. We had about 2,500 people between those two offices. And when I think about how we were seen in New York, New York is a big place. We had the aspiration of being an employer of choice. And in New York, that's very difficult. We also looked across the types of roles we had across those 2,500 people. And look, the standard of living in many of those folks were facing. They faced long commutes. Cost of living in New York is significantly above the national average. If you think about what it's like living in New York City, it's hard to have a normal life. The idea of getting in a car and going to a grocery store, that doesn't exist in New York City. So we started to think about what would we want it to look like. We set a few goals. One is we wanted to be an employer of choice in the region that we had our head office. We wanted all of the folks, whether you're an associate or the portfolio manager, we wanted them to have an above average standard of living in that area. And we wanted to try it as we were going through that. We knew this cost of living. We knew that it was expensive in New York. So we set ourselves some goals around savings. And so the process started locally. We started looking, okay, if it's not Sixth Avenue, New York, could it be other parts of New York? Could it be Jersey City? Could it be Long Island City? We quickly realized that the impact of the people that would be coming to our office would be as great as if we moved a long way away. And so we started the thought process around, okay, what would it look like if we were to move out of the New York region? So like everything, AB, it started with a spreadsheet. So we have a real estate broker who helped us with a quant screen of all of the things that we wanted. We had a rough scale in mind, 2 to 4 million person area. We wanted lower cost of living, a place where good educational establishments around, a place where it was a net importer of talent, so where people were coming in, places with lower or no tax, places that had good schools, places that had good transportation. We have a lot of people coming in and out, so places with good airports. So we started off with a screen. I think we had 20 cities on the original quant screen, and we went to visit 10 of them. So through 2017, a team of us, we would go in for a week, and it would feel like we lived at the city. We would try and commute. We would go and meet all of the schools, the religious institutions. We would go out at night. We would try the restaurants. We would meet with the Chamber of Commerce. We would meet with businesses that were established in the region, but also businesses that had also moved to the region. And at the end of all of this, we would write a whole bunch of notes up, and then we would move on to the next city. So towards the end of 17, we ended up with a shortlist of 4, of which Nashville was one. And we went back to those cities and we spent a longer time there. So a couple of weeks there, and to really get a sense of which one of these cities would be home. And towards the very early part of 2018, we made the decision of Nashville. And then that in itself felt like both the end of a long search process, but the start line to the movement of folks, which was a 4-year process.
What was the initial response of, here's what we're doing?
It was a range of responses. I think even today, we're probably one of the few, if only, asset management firms to make such a bold choice to take our head office out in New York and move that many people. I think there were some folks that were disappointed. Whenever you deal with any sort of office move, you'll find a million reasons why people can't move, and they're all understandable and you have to be compassionate. But that drives some disappointment. Excitement. There are a bunch of people who were immediately interested and were like, I want to do this. This is a once in a lifetime, once in a career opportunity to go and build something from scratch. There wasn't a lot of blueprints for people doing what we'd done. The process of communicating something like that is difficult, and we tried to be as transparent and compassionate and as upfront with people as we could be. We told them everything we knew on day one. That this was going to take 4 years. There was going to be opportunities for everybody to move, but there were going to be also people who couldn't move, and we knew that, and we wanted their help. So we tried to be compassionate and transparent, and that worked.
And did you get the city of Nashville involved with the conversations, given the size of your footprint?
Yeah, the city of Nashville very much involved in courting us, for want of a better word. So whenever you're going to bring a business to a city of the scale we had, with the types of jobs we have, cities are interested in doing that. At the time, Nashville was importing about 100 people a day. And the folks who were in the leadership roles in Nashville had a vision for it growing and continuing to grow. And the type of business we were bringing very much fitted into that vision. And so they were very much involved in helping us make the decision. But then once we'd made the decision, yes, we had folks from the Chamber of Commerce, we had folks from real estate brokers, we had folks from schools come up to New York and talk to our employees and give them a view of what Nashville was like. We then offered anybody who was interested what we called a look trip, which was a 3-day version of the week-long process we'd done the year before. So we tried to give them a taste of Nashville in a short period as possible. So show them where the office was going to be, show them schools, show them places of worship, show them what houses could look like, hook them up with a real estate broker for the afternoon. And so we went through this process of quickly trying to give people a vision of what their life in Nashville could look like. And the city and state were very helpful in that process.
If you rewind, I mean, this is a success story, but is there any lessons learned, anything you might do different or suggest to people who are making a similar leap?
With the benefit of hindsight, I would say don't do it in the middle of a global pandemic. That would have been one piece of advice. But if I saw that coming, I don't think I'd be sat here. It's really hard to move people. It really is. I mean, we spoke to people along the way when we visited all of those other cities. And the consistent feedback we got from people who had moved their companies was you can rarely move more than 25%, generally move about 20% of the people. And that was largely in line with what we found. I would say, I guess if anyone's facing the same challenge, the one thing you got to do is you know you've got to bootstrap the whole place. So you need the seeds to be able to do that. And so the first thing I'd done is go out and get the people who I thought could seed all of the departments that we needed to create, and made sure that if I couldn't get the person running the department, I got the person who was next in line or was the deputy, knowing that we needed subject matter expertise that needed to come with us. I think I had somewhere between 70 and 80 roles written down in the back of my notebook. Not names, but I need the heads of these things. And I filled that in first, made sure I got that group of people. And then that allowed us, regardless of what came next, at least allowed us to build. In some cases, we were able to bring enough people to really just bring the whole processes and department over. In many cases, it meant we had to build that from scratch. And so it was hiring people who were new to the role, training them, being in a 50-50 model, and then slowly winding down what was in New York and taking up here. And that process was an iterative process that took many years. We set ourselves 4 years to do the move, and it took all 4 years.
Did you have to go in and just talk to people and get a sense of, hey, are you going to come or are you going to stay?
Yeah, exactly.
Be vulnerable and have those dialogues, which is a very hard conversation.
I would say that list grew. The first list was probably 15 people. And the discussion was very much what you just said, very much along lines of make yourself vulnerable, be honest. I said to each of those folks, I cannot do this without you. I'll be honest with you. I see this as an incredible opportunity in my career. Arguably, I don't think I would have got to become COO if I hadn't gone through this process. I didn't have the benefit of that hindsight, but I said, look, there is an opportunity here to have a part in building what the firm's going to be for the next 20, 30 years. And those don't come along very often. I think honesty and vulnerability got us a fair number of the core people, and we built out from there.
Based on all those evolutions, where are you today, headcount-wise, assets, et cetera?
So company's 50-plus years old, 500 or so investment professionals, over $725 billion on assets under management, split across a bunch of different distribution channels. So institutions is about 300 or plus, retail, heading towards the same size, 290 or so. And then in the wealth management side, we have about $120 billion with about 240 advisors. The wealth management business is US based. So if you think about draw the map of US, plot where the large population centers are, that's what the wealth management business looks like. The rest of the business is global with large offices in London, Luxembourg, Nashville, New York, Hong Kong, Tokyo, those are the big ones. San Antonio is another large office for us from an operations perspective. In terms of the services we offer, broad range. So traditional equities is about 300 billion, fixed income, 280, multi-asset and alternatives is about 135. We've been building our alternatives business out for the last 10 or so years.
And what's your position on the alternatives with the wealth channel? How are you guys approaching that growing segment?
From a strategy perspective, I think many of our peers are doing similar things. We're looking at alternatives. Many of our wealth management clients are looking for exposure to alternatives. We also have an aspiration to continue growing in the insurance space. Our parent company, Equitable, obviously has a large insurance book. They're looking for access to alternatives. And so it's a key part of our strategy is to grow either organically or inorganically, building alternatives teams and then using both that insurance and the wealth management channel. And then increasingly the other channels, retail and institutional as well, to sell those products.
What are your priorities and main initiatives today?
This could be a busier time. We've got so much going on. It's hard to keep track of it all. We announced that we have formed a joint venture, our sell side business, Bernstein, which you may have seen some of the analyst reports from over the years. We've spun that out to be a joint venture with SocGen. That's been something that we've been working on for a long period of time. That's at least a couple of years in the making. And the thinking being there that that business in a post-MIFID world has much more opportunity for growth connected to someone with more capital, so connecting to a bank, and so that who can monetize that research in other ways, whether it's through investment banking type activities or other things. That helps us have more focus in the business, focus purely on the asset and wealth side. In addition to that, we have for the last 5 years been in the process of applying for an onshore fund management license. And so we finally got that process complete at the end of last year, our licensing processing complete. We spent last year going through the license processing, doing all the appropriate testing, getting the license approved. And then in the middle of March, we went through our first fund's IPO process. So we launched an equity product there, which closed last week. We managed to raise almost 500 million renminbi in that first product. So that's been a huge effort by people across the organization to, first of all, set our sights on China, set up the licensing process, build the infrastructure, and then raise the assets. And so that's big.
What does infrastructure mean from your perspective?
Absolutely everything. Imagine arriving with an office with nothing in it. Every system, every process, every person. We hired a local CEO. We moved folks from a US business and then hired people out there. We then had to select all of the operating platforms. So transfer agent, fund accounting, portfolio management, shareholder reporting tools, the whole gamut of tools, front office, portfolio management, trading and execution, all of those tools had to be selected. They all had to be integrated. We had to hire the people to operate them. We had to build out all the procedures. Then with all of that stuff, with the paint arguably still drying, go through all of the CSRC's acceptance processes to make sure that our processes met their local regulatory regime. The way you operate that business in China is you have to build it all from scratch. And that's very different to wherever else we operate. If we decide we're going to provide services in a country, we usually leverage everything else we've got. We may be setting up a sales office. We may be building some feeders appropriate to a currency, but it's not like we're going in and building the entire business again.
And do they have to be different?
They don't have to be different, but there are some rules around what you can share. Well, it gets complicated quickly because today the products that we're selling there is a China A share product to Chinese investors. But let's just say for argument's sake, we had something similar in the US. We wouldn't be able to have the same portfolio management team managing it. And they'd want to see that separation of both infrastructure and decision making.
And how much of the team that was added was legacy versus new?
Almost all of the team was new. In the same way I talked about Nashville, where we had to create a bootstrap. So I had a couple of folks who worked with me, one in particular, who had grown up in China, but was living in the US, was a US national. And I'd hired him way back in the web days when I was talking to you about when we were first doing web technology. And he had said, which he'd forgotten, at some point he'd mentioned to me in his job interview that he one day thought he would go back to live in China. So 20 something years later, I reminded him of that fact, which he claimed he didn't say. But he did then sign up to go out and give it a try to build the infrastructure. And so the gentleman's name's Bing Li. He was our main tech and ops person on the ground. He'd had the opportunity to work in the sales business. He'd worked in a different investment group. He'd worked in our multi-asset group. He'd had a chance to be close to operations. And so he had very similar experience that I had, which was helpful because it meant I had someone who maybe wasn't an expert in all of those areas, but had seen all of those areas and had the relationships with all the folks back in the US.
And you've done other further expansion too. Is there something going on in India?
That's very exciting for us. So coming back to this idea that pretty much all of this stuff goes around talent and being an employer of choice, we've got folks with lots of different offshore providers, but one of them was an affiliate relationship with a previous parent company. And they provided, we had a 260, 270 folks who were working for them and doing operational tasks for us, institutional management operations tasks, settlement, reconciliation, that type of stuff. And they had come to us and said, look, over time, we don't want to do this with affiliates any longer. This is really something we do for our businesses and you're no longer part of that. So we should start to plan to break up at some point. And that got myself and Rob McWilliams thinking about, well, what would it look like if we took the same model we applied in Nashville and applied that in India? One of the things that had been a concern was that the turnover had become quite high in that group. And we had lots of thoughts as to why that could be. But when we started to think about, oh, how do we make it better? We kept coming back to this idea of what I've touched on along the way. I mentioned it with Bing, I mentioned it with myself. This idea that you could start in the organization as one thing and your ability to grow through the organization is largely unlimited. My title was software engineer. I didn't have a corporate title. I was a software engineer and I've gone through becoming an AVP, a VP, an SVP, and then my functional title is the global COO. That opportunity to go through those different stages of growth, we thought that was probably the most important thing to keeping people in an organization. At the same time, we were coming out of a pandemic where people had used as a land grab to hire as many people as they possibly could. And so labor market was super tight. So we started thinking, if we were in Pune, where there's an awful lot of investment management talent, if we were there as an employer of choice, what would that do for our turnover? What would that do for our ability to move other roles to that office? And could that somehow be self-fulfilling? And if we can move other roles, we can have this opportunity to give people a full life cycle or a full opportunity to evolve through career at AB. So we made the decision to set up AB in Pune. Our first step was we took a floor in an office park called Jira. We took a floor in one of their buildings, very similar to the sort of office building you'd see in either New York or Nashville. But we made an interesting decision. We built that office out exactly as a replica to what we have here. So it wasn't built up like a back office or a call center. It was built to look like this one, which is predominantly open plan, a good mix of spaces where you can sit at a desk, but a good mix of other places where you can collaborate and where you can do focused work. So we took those first group of people over. Again, this is an idea of planting a seed. We had a guy called Anthony Rizzi, who was a culture carrier for our operations team. And he worked with a gentleman called Chris Biffin, who was also very instrumental in making these decisions and building out the Indian office. And we thought, look, if we're going to build something like Nashville, we need someone who can go there and put the cultural flag, can talk about what it is to be at AB, can actually start making these changes such that people can see that there's a career path, can be a point of contact for other businesses that want to move people and roles out there. And so Anthony moved to Nashville with us, and we had a conversation with him and offered him another opportunity, an opportunity to go there and be the CEO of this business. And so he went out and was very, very instrumental in setting it up. He built the culture of that office. He put the employee working groups together. Played in the sports teams. He went to people's birthdays and weddings and became a real cultural point for that office. At the same time as he was doing that, we were working here in both US and other offices, outlining roles and describing the types of opportunities that there was for talent in that marketplace. And so we started expanding outside of the investment management operations roles. Those first set of new roles, many of them were filled by people coming out of the investment management operations teams. And that really kicked off this process of the idea that, okay, look, I can start in one role and I can end up in another. And so we've been at that now for about 18 months, continues to grow at an accelerating rate. Other groups have moved roles there and we've followed the same model. So for example, in our wealth management team, traditionally, the associates who support the wealth management advisors are sit very close, but we've built a team out there. We seconded a senior wealth management associate to go out there and train folks. So that model continues to be used over and over again, where we take someone who's got that skill, move them to a different market and have them help build it out.
So it's had an interesting implication on the talent pool approach, leaving New York and adding different international offices. How do you think about the talent pool today? Does it feel different? Is it more people relocating to Nashville for an opportunity at AB, or are they local?
I would think about that in a couple of different timelines. Pre-COVID, when the employee-employer contract changed a bit through COVID, pre-COVID, it was very different. And so if you had people who faced some of the flexibility issues I mentioned, long commute, high cost of living, you could look at a number of cities in the Northeast where you could find a whole swath of people who fit that criteria and were interested in moving. It was very, very easy to move people pre-COVID. If I had a role that needed real specialist skill set, we have a great internal recruiting team. They could do that without even needing to go to a market-specific recruiter. I think COVID changed that a little bit. So when you look at it today, most of what we're doing is we're hiring people who are professionals, maybe not in the exact same area, or we're hiring people into our associate programs, which are two-year rotational programs, and we're seeding roles that way. And that's appropriate, I think, because much of what we've built over the last 5.5 years here have worked that way. Now we've got institutional momentum here in Nashville. We've got a team of people. It's much easier to add a couple of people to a team that's got momentum than it is to build 40 teams and get them up to some level of momentum from scratch. So I think it's changed a little bit, but it's probably more us changing than the landscape.
Exciting times. And I have to ask, what are you doing about AI? have to ask a former CTO about your approach to AI.
How long you got? There's lots to be said. I've generally thought about it in three buckets: the NLP stuff, the analytical AI tools, and then what we've seen more recently, the generative creative AI tools. They're useful for different things. So the NLP side of things, think about being able to connect with data and applications in a more human way, having the ability for our tools to have chat front ends, having the ability to ask questions that are hard to describe with a mouse, but maybe can be easily described in a written sentence. Like, what would it look like if this portfolio had more exposure to X? So the NLP stuff, we've had some success internally and externally using that tool. The analytical side of things, I think about that as, can you use an AI tool to compress a large amount of information to the stuff that's the most relevant? And so that's helpful for the people in our portfolio management teams. It's helpful for our analysts. It's helpful in the operations space. When I think about something like security setup, and we need to work out if a security is ERISA eligible before we put it into our security master, that involves reading an offering document. Maybe an analytical AI can do that and pull out that information. Maybe it can be one source, or maybe it can be one of the verification sources, or maybe it can be the source. But the idea of those analytical tools is important. And then the bit that I didn't see coming at all was the generative creative stuff, which is, as you know, not much more than a year old, maybe a little bit older than that. But this idea that you can use them for creative output is incredible. When I think about that, I think about it being able to get technology into parts of the business that have been traditionally very, very hard. As COO, I work very closely with our legal compliance team. And when I think about, with my previous hat on as CTO, when I provided technology to the head of legal, at most, I probably provided them a document management system, maybe a contract management system. There's nothing I did that moved the efficiency of our legal team except around the margin. Made it a bit easier for them to find things, maybe a bit easier to maybe manage workflow. Then you look at something like a generative AI, where you can feed in a contract and say, look, this is the contract, and can you make it in an English language prompt that can spit out the next generation or the first draft of the next contract? That's something that I might have had to go to outside counsel to do historically. And now I'm doing that, not only doing it at all, but doing it in incredibly short periods of time. So now this idea of the blank sheet of paper or the first draft that in these creative roles that these generative AI tools are able to get at, that's going to be a game changer.
Anybody in position of having to write a first draft of an offering document of an investment offering, that's where the friction is. Once you have the first draft, it's a lot easier, but getting the flywheel going is hard.
Exactly. And it does that in an incredibly powerful way. I do think the governance of this stuff is important and the management of it is important. We have a governance committee that we've put together to think about how we use these things. I think we're just at the start of this boom, and I think it's going to be .com boom in size, and we're going to see a huge amount of investment. And I think these capabilities are going to spring up in many, many tools. One of the things that we think about, because I think regulation is going to take some time to catch up, and I think our clients are going to start to get their head around this, and they're going to ask us a lot of questions around it as well. One of the things I've been trying to drive through our thought process is, look, today I think about these, and Andrew Chin, who actually runs our AI team, talks about it this way. He talks about it like the Iron Man suit. It's not replacing the person, it is giving them capabilities that they didn't have before.
I like that.
But at the heart of it, there's still a human making the decision. And I think that's probably a safe place to be as we deal with regulators and our clients as this stuff evolves.
Well, Carl, this has been a fascinating conversation. Appreciate you sharing your story. We'd like to close with two questions. And one is, what advice would you give to an emerging manager from an operational perspective?
I would come back to some of the things I said earlier. Get an opportunity to try lots of different parts of the operation. If you're in corporate actions, go learn settlements. If you're in settlements, go learn reconciliation. Make sure you've got a broad understanding of how all the pieces fit together. I would say technology is going to continue to revolutionize the work you do. So go learn what an AI prompt means, or go do some data analytics type courses. None of these things are particularly rocket science, but a small amount of understanding and insight will have a massive impact on your ability to have impact. And then I would say just recognizing that the operational teams are support teams in a large organization, I would say don't take things personally. Lots of things change in that type of role. You're going to see a lot of different ins and outs. You know, learn to be able to separate your personal feelings from outcomes in the office. And I think those three pieces of advice would probably help maybe get you a long way, get you somewhere along the path.
Good stuff. And then the other question is, what piece of, it could be reading material, website, anything that you commonly refer to people in industry?
I read a lot, both fiction and historical factual books. There's not one website that I find myself going to over and over again. I mean, obviously there's the sit in front of Bloomberg and read the news as often, like it's my job. But in terms of one space where it's to go and get advice for the sort of things we do, I just tend to generally read a lot as best I can.
Well, Carl, thanks for the time. It's been great to hear the story about AB, and we're excited about following where you guys go.
Awesome. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you like what you heard, hop on our website at capitalallocators.com, where you can access past shows, join our mailing list, and sign up for premium content. Have a good one, and see you next time.